It has been such a privilege to be with you this weekend and to hear your stories and hopes and dreams. And yes, how no piece of good has been wasted. And this is but a beginning, one of many, but a beginning of a bold new time. After worship, please look at the wall in the room whose name I've lost behind that wall. Thank you. Where there is the beginnings of people's dreams for the next chapter. What stories will you tell about the next 10 years? Please add your dreams. There were many hopes for the future named on Friday. For those of you who were there, these were the blue and yellow slips of paper. Many hopes. Three were said over and over again in different words. We want to learn trust. We want this to be a place that balances head and heart and centers love. We want to continue and deepen our social justice legacy. The way I might say that is that I believe our collective work is wholeness and healing, whole society healing and very personal healing, that the healing of me and you and us is bound up in the healing of the world. Years ago, I was attending yet another UU congregation. I sat in the back because I didn't yet know anyone, and I introduced myself saying, "I haven't met you yet." And when someone told me they were new, also sitting in the back, I'd ask, "What brought you here today?" And often a story would pour out of divorce, the death of a parent, or a deep existential crisis. And there we were in the emptying sanctuary in the holy presence of pain and tears. I stopped being surprised by this years ago. There are many reasons to begin attending a congregation, but they have to be strong enough to overcome the draw of a warm bed, a morning at home, and face an unknown place with unknown rituals to be a stranger. Another story. I was deeply shaped by being raised in a Unitarian Universalist congregation in New Hampshire. One way they shaped me is telling me explicitly and implicitly the story that racism is over. We ended that in the 1960s when we marched. And yet, when I was a young adult in my first anti-racism workshop, which was not a Unitarian Universalist one, I felt my Sunday school teachers all around me. I felt them coming to the awareness of systemic racism that I was, and I heard them say, "We can't not do this. We can't be who we are as Unitarian Universalists and not work for racial justice." My faith community called me as a white person to the work of racial justice, called me for my own wholeness in the ways racism and white supremacy has limited my life, and called me for the wholeness of the world. I believe our collective work is wholeness and healing, whole society healing and very personal healing. My colleague, Reverend Nancy Bowen, says it maybe better. She says, "The purpose of the church is to heal the consequences of lovelessness and injustice in the hearts and souls of our members so they might heal the community and together heal the world. The purpose of church is to heal the consequences of lovelessness and injustice in the hearts and souls of our members so they might heal the community and together heal the world." Lovelessness and injustice, or just lovelessness, for as Dr. Cornel West says, justice is what love looks like in public. What lovelessness? All the ways, large and small, many of us were hurt as children, some taught shame and fear, some learning not to trust others, some learning not to trust ourselves. Abuse and harassment of all kinds. The seemingly random life wounds, bullies and cliques, careless lovers, cruel bosses, crumbled marriages and lost dreams, financial disaster and disease. All the ways the world has said we are not good enough, because we are women, because we are queer, because of our culture, because we are not white, because we are not able-bodied, because we don't come from the right kind of people. All the ways we were allowed to hurt others, even encouraged to sometimes, because we were better than them. The soul-crushing experience of being stuck in a system which does not see the fullness of our lives or care about the quality of our lives. Even the ways we have hurt one another. We are here to heal the consequences of lovelessness and injustice in each other. I have seen UU congregations and youth cons and summer camps do this in so many ways. We offer each other acceptance, often acceptance of the very ways of being we have experienced rejection. We see each other in our unique, contradictory human selves. We stick it out when our very humanness brings us into disagreement. We love anyway. We relearn trust. We offer belonging. We listen. So often healing comes when others hear us into our wholeness. And the heart of all of this is being present with each other in joy, sorrow, confusion, and pain. It is countercultural to be present to such emotions. Our world pushes us to fix, to find a solution, to throw ourselves into the work, to stay busy with the fixing, and never feel. We are countercultural in the time we share in worship, being with what is. We are countercultural in giving and receiving pastoral care. Pastoral care is not about solving. It is about keeping each other company, even when life is painful and hard and there is nothing to be done, even when the doctors have no more solutions, even when ICE is taking a loved one away for deportation. Sometimes, healing the consequences of lovelessness is just being there, being present, with empathy and caring. But to be present requires a kind of time and space that the frenzy of fixing prevents. We need time and space to absorb what is, to feel our own grief and pain, anger, despair. Without this, we cannot be present to another in pain because their pain touches the pain we are trying not to feel. We can try to feel, not to feel in so many ways. We can drop out of someone's life because we don't know what to do or say. We can say insensitive things that are really more about comforting us than them. I'm sure it's for the better. There's always a reason. When we are trying to help others but cannot be present to our feelings about how much suffering and injustice there is in the world, instead of being present, we come across as condescending and pitying, and few people, even though they might need the help, want help that comes with that kind of emotional baggage. The pressure to fix comes with a pressure to know the answers, to be sure enough and competent and smart enough to do the right thing and fix things the right way. White liberals, who I claim is my people in particular, have a long history of trying to fix things for marginalized groups and doing fixing in ways that are ultimately harmful. We need humility of not knowing. When you told stories on Friday night, we lifted up that some stories have different versions. There's a story about the story. This is a story with two very different versions that I want to share with you in this moment. This story happened at the close of General Assembly in 2005. The week had included many moments which hurt youth and young adults of color. There's a long report available online if you want to read all of that, and it's powerful. This is but one moment. Reverend Wendy is speaking in the voice of a religious professional woman of African descent.
That evening, I was riding a crowded elevator with several emotionally exhausted youth and young adults of color that final night of GA. Two of the youth had just been involved in a near altercation with a white female minister outside of the closing ceremony. The elevator stopped, and as the doors opened, I heard another white woman yelling at the youth of color in the elevator, if people really want to be anti-racist, you will get off the elevator now and allow this poor man to get on. I peered outside the doors and saw an older black hotel employee with a food cart. I saw the shame and embarrassment on his face. I remember a flood of emotion. In his eyes, I saw me. And I wondered, what am I doing with rude, insensitive white people so far removed from his world, my roots? What am I doing here when incidents like this happen again and again and again? But I stayed on that elevator. I stood my ground. I belonged on that elevator, too.
Reverend Lynn is speaking in the voice of a white UU minister.
That evening, I went to where the dance was to be held, and I learned that the dance had been canceled because the youth community was feeling broken by incidents of racism. Leaving the ballroom, I saw an older black hotel employee waiting for the elevator, waiting with a food service cart. An elevator arrived, and a dozen YRUU youth hurried past him to fill it. This happened twice. He told me that he'd been waiting for some time as this scenario repeated itself. The third time the elevator arrived and youth rushed to enter, I interrupted to ask if they would step out and let the man in. The youth were screaming at me that their world was broken. I told them that if they were concerned about racism, they would care about this man. I reminded them that everyone at GA was privileged and urged them to look after the hotel staff. I got on the elevator and continued to talk to the youth. Then an adult woman of color said to me, "You need to stop now and go be with your white community and talk about this." I was shaken. I'd been at the closing ceremony, but I had no clue what had happened with the youth or what I had gotten into. This was one of the most unpleasant experiences in my entire life.
There are many lessons in this story of these two intersecting layers of injustice. One might be that this white UU minister acted and didn't stand back. No piece of good is ever wasted, and we don't learn if we don't try. Another is about how who we are and what we know affects how we show up. One for me that I hear is the ways I've been told as a white person is my job to know the answers and fix the problems, and the mess I might make if I don't come in with presence and attention in the moment and with enough humility to know I might not know. My mother's family has deep New England Puritan roots. They don't talk about their feelings or what is real, and together we embody the stereotype that white educated New Englanders think they know all the solutions to all the world's problems if only people would do as we say. Recently, I listened to a Black woman describe her family reunions and how her family taught her resilience in the face of hardship, how to have joy and celebrate even though life is hard. My white family didn't give me any of that. I think we forgot how. Instead, they taught me how to pretend everything was great, that we were great, our family wonderful, and how not to talk about anything that contradicted that story, including at least 3 generations of girls who grew up with sexual abuse. We do not know how, my family does not know how, to be with the consequences of lovelessness. I do not tell you so much about me because I assume you are like me. I tell you about me to inspire you to your own continual deepening about how you were shaped by skin color, class, geography, gender, family, culture, and more. There is no "we all had that particular experience." We cannot assume by what we see each other's cultural shaping, but to truly be present and to be humble, we have to know ourselves well enough to recognize what we bring with us into a room. This next hymn comes from the shape note or sacred harp singing tradition. This singing tradition originated in New England in about 1801 to facilitate the learning of songs because each note has its own shape. The music faded from the north by the late 1800s and was preserved and passed on in Appalachia. It is traditionally sung in a square in 4-part harmony. The harmonies are not likely to be what you are used to. They feel sharp, real to me, not comfortable or complacent. Most of the songs in this tradition are explicitly Christian and express faith in the face of life's suffering. This musical tradition tells me there was a time my ancestors knew about pain and knew how to give voice to the pain in their lives in a way that brought them strength. Now, when I say that the purpose of church is to heal the consequences of lovelessness and injustice, I do not pretend to know what that looks like for you, either as individuals or as a congregation. You have your own unique constellations of gifts, talents, passions, resources, your own individual and collective needs, and this city and county has its own needs and opportunities. I do know that a congregation that does not share a sense of common direction can row in circles like a boat without a coxswain to call directions, where each rower does their own thing on their own. A congregation can be so frazzled with too many things going on, pulling in members in too many directions, so that even beloved ministries fall flat without enough volunteer support. We face this in ourselves, too. I doubt I am alone in sometimes finding myself on the internet without much purpose, and later realizing I am not devoting myself to the things that are most important in my life. Missing time, again, I could be spending with friends or family or staying up too late. If we are to get anywhere, we need to be able to pull in the same direction. The need, both for ourselves and our collective, is discernment. We cannot say yes if we cannot say no. If I cannot say no to the demands of my time, which pull me away from my deepest commitments, I cannot really say yes to anything. So too, congregations must say no as well as yes. You might say, that idea is really exciting, but we made a commitment to Family Promise, and we will not schedule anything that overloads our volunteers during that week. Your no is not just about schedules or building availability, but about your deeper purpose, including stepping away from the frenetic busyness so you can be human beings together, not human doings. To be present to one another, do the growing and learning and healing to become who you can become. Because a ministry like Family Promise doesn't just need things done. People also need the kind of presence that takes time to feel and become. So that you could all pull in the same direction, last year your congregation undertook a great work of daring and faith and rewrote your governance structure. Your new policy-based governance forms ways for you to say yes and no. And yesterday, your co-ministers, your board of trustees, and your governance advisory committee charted where all the authority lies to say yes and no for the many areas of congregational life. There's a lot of work left to be done. Knowing who says yes or no is not yet knowing how, when, what processes, or by what criteria. This is a time of in between old ways of doing things and not yet in the new. I invite you to see this as a time of spiritual deepening. It's okay not to know. It's okay to be a time of uncertainty. It's a good time in our world to flex our spiritual muscles and get better at living with uncertainty. And you're doing this together with your leaders and your new co-ministers. Reverend Wendy and Lynn are just as much in this time of not knowing. You may have already heard them asking lots of questions. They will keep asking you lots of questions. These questions and your answers and the conversations exploring the how, when, why to say yes or no are also about building trust. Trust with your new ministers, trust with your current leaders, trust with your future leaders. And as part of this building trust with each other and in a time of uncertainty, I invite you to be part of practicing saying no. If you have an idea and hear a no, I invite you to celebrate. Celebrate that your leaders are living into the new structures you've chosen and told them to live into. Celebrate and then reflect with them. Did the new process lead to the right no and the right yes? New structures and processes will not be instantly anything like a well-oiled machine. Change means trying things out, seeing what happens. This is a more enjoyable experience if it can be a little playful. Play lets us drop our need to be right and perfect, makes room for the things we might call mistakes, and lets us learn far better than anger and blame do. What if, with a twinkle in your eye and an invitation to your leaders to practice no, could be fun? I hope you don't hear the word play as not taking you seriously. I do. I take so seriously the inspiring journey that you've undertaken to move with faith into a way of being a religious community that will pull you in the same direction. We can each make a difference in our own individual lives, but together as a collective, we can make a bigger impact on the world. You told me stories of the kinds of ways you have made that impact in the past, of founding a local Planned Parenthood and a co-op and more, and you said that's what you see in your future. Pulling together will mean you can make a bigger impact in healing the consequences and lovelessness of injustice in your lives, in this community, in Schenectady, and in the world. It's a powerful vision.